Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about programming, development, and design through the lens of amazing books chapter by chapter. Hi, I'm John, and I am joined by JP.
Hey, so today we will be going through Chapter 5 and continuing our discussion about the guiding principles of extreme programming. In last week's episode, or the last episode rather, we talked about values, which are sort of like the roots of things that we don't like in situations, which is a very abstract thing. The way I like to think about values are, it's sort of like the North Star. Like, what is our mantra? What kind of, what are these kind of abstract things that drive us to do the things that we do? So today we're going to be talking about principles, which, because values are so abstract, we need something that is a little bit more concrete, and that's exactly what principles are. So that is a little introduction to today's episode. John, how's it going?
It's going good, man. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. It's just very hot, and our office in Los Angeles is not suited for conditions as such. Our air conditioning unit is like going through some repairs right now, so we all have these like little desk fans, which is, it's not ideal to say the least. But other than that, I'm doing great.
I love hearing people complain about weather, because I live right on the coast, and it's always a perfect 70 degrees here. It rarely ever changes, and I just love it. I have video calls and stuff with people all over the world, and it's just so nice to be like, they always ask me how the weather is, and I don't even have to look outside, or I just know.
You just feel
it's 70 degrees and sunny. It's always wonderful.
Oh man, that's what I miss about living on the west side. I lived in Playa del Rey about 2 years ago, and you always get that nice marine layer, I think is what it's called.
Yeah, marine layer. That's right. So I'm excited to jump into the book this week. So it's interesting. Extreme programming, as we were saying, is like way different than I expected. It's way less extreme in ways that I thought were going to be very different. It's more extreme when it comes to like your values and your own boundaries and respecting your own humanity and those types of things. It's really interesting. But not to talk too much on that, but I wanted to kind of give a context for where we're going into these principles. You were helping with that a little bit. But the book really first starts talking off about values, which feed into principles, and then principles feed into practices. So it's really more about like understanding what your base motivations are for things. And then within your motivations, what are the principles that guide those values or motivations? And then I feel like after we get into each of these principles, we're going to start digging into specific practices. And so the conversation is a little bit more abstract still, which is totally great. I feel like I'm getting a ton out of going through this kind of strategic and intentional thinking about what guides my behavior and choices, and realizing for me lately, something I've been realizing more and more is, like, at least for me, owning my own company and being a freelancer, I actually dictate my own schedule, and I actually can kind of craft my own schedule and career. And I think a lot of people have that power and they don't realize that. But what I'm actually struggling with more than anything lately is like, well, what's even my underlying value? How do I want to structure my career? Like, do I want a 4-day work week? Do I want a 3-day work week? Do I want an 8-day work week? Like, what does that look like? And what is really driving that? And those are the hard questions. And I feel like I'm very blessed to be somebody who gets to ask those questions. Like, a lot of people just have to work whatever job they get, and they don't really get to think about their values or principles that guide their work, or some of these opportunities and principles that we're talking through are things that are a luxury. And I just want to take a second and just realize that it's so wonderful to be in an industry and a career where we even have the luxury of looking at these things, being able to think about our values and principles that guide our work. I'm really thankful for that. As we get into these principles and start to understand the principles that guide extreme programming that we can learn from.
Yeah, totally. And I think that might be a good example to kickstart this conversation, is maybe trying to reverse engineer this practice of having a 4-day work week, just at a high level, because it sounds like, you know, if you start there and you start to wonder like, okay, so my practice is having a 4-day work week. So what are my principles and values? Maybe my principles are like work-life balance, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe the value to that is being healthy, or maybe those are the values and practices that drive you as a business owner, right? So, but that is a little bit different than the values and practices that drive extreme programming. But I think that is a perfect example of thinking about like what is your North Star, for example, if we're talking about the context of the practice of enforcing a 4-day work week, for example.
Yeah. I don't have a 4-day work week. I wish I did, to be clear. But yeah, and I like that extreme programming does present that. You know, the author is very much, these are the principles that I've found a lot of value in, and here's the practices that I've found a lot of value in. But the author is very clear that you might have values or principles that are different than this book. And the author is also just encouraging you to find the values that you feel like are very valuable to you and find those principles within those values that are valuable to you. And so I think that's a perfect example of kind of reverse engineering the 4-day work week. You know, I want to be healthy. That's my value. And therefore my principle is work-life balance. And then my practice is a 4-day work week. So that's not the exact practices we're going to be going through, but we're going to talk about the principles specific within extreme programming. Just to rattle them off, this is a big list, but these are them. We're only going to pick a few that kind of jumped out to us. The chapter goes in a lot of depth about every one of these, but here are all the principles that guide extreme programming. And maybe they're principles you want to adapt to. So here we go. It's humanity, economics, mutual benefit, self-similarity, improvement, diversity, reflection, flow, opportunity, redundancy, failure, quality, baby steps, accepted responsibility. So that's the whole list. And I feel like some of those is like, what the hell is self-similarity? Or what the hell is, you know, reflection as a principle?
But some of them flow?
Are, yeah, what's flow? That's another one that's a good one. But some of them are super straightforward, like accepted responsibility, failure, opportunity. Like some of these are pretty clear, but some of them are a little bit more abstract. But we've just kind of picked a few to go deeper on and talk about from our context, how we find values in those principles and kind of what the book also says you should get out of them.
Yeah, cool. So let's dive into it. But before I do that, I just want to reiterate. So we're going from abstract to more concrete. So the values were like really super abstract. I don't want to read them off because we just read off a list of 14 things and you don't want to bore you with that. And then so today we're going to be talking about principles, which are a little bit more concrete because they sort of drive these values. And you can't necessarily guide behavior based off values, but you can guide behavior based off of principles, which is what we're talking about today again. And then so in subsequent episodes, we'll talk about practices. So practices are actual action items. So if we're thinking about like, how can I actually do these things that principles are trying to guide, that is the episode to look forward to. That being said, the first principle I have listed that I really wanted to talk about was humanity, which sounds just so very abstract. Like, what is humanity? So I did what every developer would do, and I looked up the definition of humanity because I feel like that will really guide this conversation better if we're all on a level playing field of what
Webster's dictionary defines humanity as.
Yeah, right. Like this is like the first sentence of an essay that I would have written in high school. Yeah. The Webster's dictionary defines humanity as a characteristic that makes us human. Right. So
that's so unclear.
Yeah. What makes us human? So I think when we talk about a couple of these characteristics, I think it will really clear things up because you're right. Like that does still sound very ambiguous, but the author poses a question and it's this. It's what do people need to be good developers? What are some basic human needs? And so he answers that with a couple bullet points, which are safety, you know, like, As a human being, I need to feel safe. I need to be able to have food. I need to be free from like physical threats. You know, there's like mental safety. Like, am I like really scared that my boss is going to fire me kind of a thing? So, you know, as a human, one of my needs is that I need to be safe, right? A couple other needs that I have are accomplishment. You know, I need to feel like the work that I'm doing it makes me feel good. You know, I need to feel like I'm contributing to society. So safety, accomplishment, there's other ones like belonging, growth, intimacy. And it's interesting because Kent Beck mentions that, you know, these requisites meet both business needs and human needs, right? So like if a company can successfully fill the needs of me feeling safe, accomplished, belonging, you know, having personal growth, then the business will thrive as well, right? So like as a developer, am I growing? Am I becoming a better developer every day? That kind of a thing, which I thought was like really interesting and still very abstract. I'm curious to see what kind of practices will drive humanity.
a principle of humanity. What kind of practices could be in there? I think it's an important principle to remember that we're human, only because we spend all day with computers. Like, that's who we hang out with. That's my friends, is all these computers. And I wish setting a new habit was as easy as scheduling a cron job for myself. Like, okay, go to the gym, 6 a.m., there's the cron job, I'm done. And I wish that, like, a good practice would just be as easy as writing a method for myself. Like, be patient with people. That's just the method. I just changed that method in the line of code in my brain. I've been watching too much Westworld where the, like, computers can, like, change their own code. But I think it's important that we remember that, like, we are way more complicated than the computers we work with, and we require a lot more. And all these things, the safety, accomplishment, belonging, it reminds me of this principle in psychology called Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And it talks through all the different things you need as a human. And, like, the base layer of that is just, like, basic food and shelter. And then as it goes up, you need things like accomplishment and growth and learning. And there's all these different things with that. But yeah, I think that's an important driving principle. So, all right, moving on to the next principle of extreme programming is self-similarity. And this, I pulled this one out because the title was not self-evident, and I thought it was a really interesting concept. So the author described walking along a beach, and he looked down and saw a tide pool in a very specific shape. And he looked up and he saw a little bit bigger of a, like, an estuary, a lake, if you will, and it was the same shape. And then he realized even bigger that the entire bay was that same shape. And basically, there's this concept of the fractal nature of geology, and where nature finds a shape that works, it uses that shape wherever nature can. And, like, this is a weird tangent here a little bit, but a crystal, and this is going into nature a little bit more in these fractal shapes. A crystal is a material whose constituents, such as atoms, molecules, or items, are arranged in a highly ordered microscopic structure. It's like, why the hell are you talking about crystals, John? The thing that's crazy about crystals is all the way to an atomic level, they're the same shape. So, like, it's the same shape within the same shape that makes the same shape. So the entire shape of a crystal has the same, nature finds that same shape that works, and it builds it all the way up to an atomic level. So all the way in and all the way up. And so this is the concept to pull from this fractal nature of, this fractal nature of geology, or this idea that when nature finds a shape, she uses it again and again. So this is the takeaway of self-similarity as a principle. So I've found that many things that prove useful at a small scale work at larger scales or medium scales. So for example, concepts like good names. Naming something well works well for a variable, a function, a method, a model, a controller, a namespace, like all the way through. Breaking things up into smaller pieces works really well, again, for a method, a function, a model, a controller. So a process, a way that you execute things. So if you have a very proven process of debugging one line of code, that similar process will probably work really well if you scale it up to a whole app. So a lot of these concepts that we find that work really well, whether they be technical or more soft skills, often have this self-similar idea. So the idea that the tide pool has the same shape as the lake, and the lake has the same shape as the entire marina or bay of the area. And I've totally found this to be true. And it's funny because we have a more junior dev on the team who started recently. And I gave this, like, same speech before I read it in the book. And I was so proud when I read it because I was basically talking through the idea of extraction. So defining your data at the top of a file, or, like, keeping your data that's, like, there's a whole example I could go to with this. We were talking about this JavaScript switch statement that was, like, very much like if. And instead we defined everything in one array at the top. And then that array defined all the different possible permutations of the switch statement. And then it just completely cleaned up all the code. So this idea of extracting the values. Also say is a lot of these principles we've talked through in refactoring, in Pooter, like on some of these books we've talked to, scale really well across a system. So have an open mind to just, like, try the same system or method in a different context. That's the idea of self-similarity. I don't know if I explained that well. That's a weird concept.
Yeah, it's hard now that we talk about them out loud and then trying to, like, actually talk about them. You're like, oh, did I just define it with its own with its own definition? Or, like, did I circularly define it? But no, I think that's good. I think the concepts that you talked about are actually kind of examples of what practices might look like in self-similarity. So, like, probably with the goal of self-similarity, you might have something like good names for functions. You know, like, a good name for a function or a method works very well in your tic-tac-toe side project, as well as in a really large production database. Like, you would never be like, oh man, why is this named so well? Like, we're in a you know, we're in pod code right here. I can't believe this is named so perfectly. That would never happen, you know? And having simplicity in your abstractions and having very clear abstractions is something that you would want in a small code base and in a large code base.
And within a code base, like within a large code base, you'd want it in a single file. You'd want it in multiple files. You'd want it in a namespace, wherever those things look like.
Yeah. So I think that's a very interesting concept. I'm really excited to read about what the practices are that actually execute these principles. So, I don't know. Do you have anything else to say about self-similarity?
No, I think that's it. I have gone on a rabbit hole of crystals. So I think we're done with that topic. We should move on.
Okay, cool. So the next principle I have is diversity, which I think deserves its own podcast episode itself.
Absolutely.
But I think it's really cool that diversity is brought up. Even, I don't know, I forget how old this book is, but I definitely don't think it's new, which just goes to show that this is potentially a pain point, has been a pain point for a while. I have a couple quotes that I think are worth reading. So here's the quote on diversity. It's this, quote, "Software development teams where everyone is alike while comfortable are not effective. Teams need to bring together a variety of skills, attitudes, perspectives to see problems and pitfalls, to think of multiple ways to solve problems and to implement the solutions. Teams need diversity," end quote. And I think diversity is important to me because I don't know. I just feel like as someone who comes from a non-traditional computer science background, I bring to the table what potentially wouldn't have been brought to the table. Now, let's take a step back. And so my sister has like spoken at conferences about diversity. And so I just feel like once I read her deck, I was like, wow, I think diversity is that much more important now. And oftentimes when you hear the word diversity and tech in the same sentence, your mind instantly goes to gender and race. But diversity is more than that. Sure, that is definitely, having different ethnicities and different genders on a team is definitely important. But there's more to diversity than that. You know, you need people who have different education backgrounds, people who come from different majors, people who came from different like socioeconomic backgrounds. Can you imagine if everyone at like, let's say you and I both have iPhones, you know, like what if everyone who worked at Apple was like a rich kid from like New York building a product for a product for like two people in California.
Yeah.
Like that's sort of how I think of things. Or like, let's say you had a team of people who are only like math people, you know, you might need someone who has like a background in art or someone who has a background in psychology to really like bring a product together. Because if you have people who are who think too similarly, you might not gain empathy for who your real users are.
Right.
So it does make sense if you're building a product for like a specific group, then sure, maybe your team's like makeup needs to be of that group so that you can empathize with them. But I feel like oftentimes that is not the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's such an important topic. I was just listening to a fantastic podcast, 99% Invisible, and the most recent episode was called Invisible Women, and it was all about diversity in design and how much traditional design has rejected women and considering women. And I know this conversation is broader than just women. It's about background, it's about race, it's about even more than that. But it was fascinating to hear about things like crash test dummies are built off the male body, and so cars are way more unsafe for women even to today. We're not testing cars for women, or things like medical trials not being done on women because they have periods and it complicates things. Like so much bullshit around how much women have been missed in design and how much opportunity is missed, not only saved lives, but literally leaving money on the table for some like pharmaceutical corporations. They potentially could have been finding medication that actually worked for women. So like trying to be efficient and just bullheaded about not including women in these studies has really not served them well. And so the takeaway is that diversity has compounding returns in almost every context it's applied. So having different types of people, men, women of race, of background, helps improve your product almost 100% across board. And so I think it's really important to keep that as a principle and keep that in mind, not only with building teams and who you're hiring and recommending for jobs and who you're including in just your network of peoples, but at the same time, the types of data we pursue and the types of users we pursue and the types of ads we place. It's like, oh, that type of user won't be interested in our product because of XYZ. You might be completely ignoring a huge market or underserving people in a way that's really damaging. So I think diversity is a really important and under talked about concept in tech. And I think it's only been recently that we're even beginning to talk about it and do anything about it. Cool.
Yep, totally. Yeah. And I think that example of the crash test dummy is like a perfect example of like a failure.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, had there been some women in the room or on that team, you know, there might have been different considerations.
What about boobs? Like, yeah. What about like just our bodies are different? Like the average weight is different. So many things. Yeah. This next topic was very near and dear to my heart, which is opportunity, which so the principle here is opportunity. And this is the quote from the book, quote, learn to see problems as opportunities for change, unquote. And it feels very like stoic, this tenet of there aren't problems. There's only opportunities. Mm-hmm. It's like, come on, what the fuck, man? There are problems. Okay. Not everything's an opportunity, but I think this is a really good way to learn from your experience and to push through hurdles and challenges. So the book continues and says, quote, to reach excellence, problems need to turn into opportunities for learning improvement, not just survival, unquote. And so a recent example from our little development firm, we had every single one of our .env files for all of our projects accidentally get posted to a public repo. It was like such an easy mistake, just like not knowing that our company handbook was public. And they're like, oh, well, let's just share all the ENV files in one repo. It'll be easy. And they didn't realize the company handbook was public. So, oh my God. But so this felt like a huge problem when this happened. I was like, oh my gosh. Like, even though they were only exposed for 5 or 6 minutes, I have to assume every one of those ENV files are compromised. The long and short of it is I'm really proud of myself the way that I treated it. I really treated it as an opportunity to invest in our systems and an opportunity for change. And so we moved away from this ENV system to a way better, more secure credentialing system, which is newer in Rails, which is way harder to leak out those potential ENVs because everything is always encrypted. So you can push it to the repo and there's one key. And then it's way easier to rotate your security key. So we use this problem as an opportunity to improve our architecture and our processes and our system within the company. But I think every time we see these big hurdles or problems or challenges, like realize that's probably where the most opportunity lies. Like whatever is frustrating in your day-to-day, not only tech, but otherwise, is probably an opportunity for a product or a service to fix that. And I think that kind of those little nuggets of opportunity show up everywhere in our life. Like what are the things that are most inconvenient and frustrating or scary in your job? Like see that as opportunities. There's a really good book on this called The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. And it just talks about everything in your life that you feel like is this really big obstacle is probably your biggest opportunity. One last quick example on this topic. I remember when I was kind of dabbling in design and kind of did Squarespace and WordPress websites, but I always saw the idea of learning to code as this huge problem, as this huge obstacle. And in reality, with my life, leaning into that and going head on into this problem of that I can't code and I'll never be able to code was the biggest opportunity I've ever had in my life. And I've come on the other side of going through that challenge or through that problem is the best opportunity, which is learning to code and becoming more competent as a developer. So I would just really encourage you. And I love this principle of seeing problems as opportunities for change. So just like reframe that in your mind. It doesn't have to be problems. It doesn't have to be blockers.
Yeah. Wow. I really enjoy that. Just sort of seeing things through a different lens, I think is really interesting. It's funny because, you know, as developers, everyone and everything is always poking holes in our work. Users are breaking our app. It's like, stop doing that, you know? And it just seems like if you keep thinking of things as like another thing is broken or I have another problem or I have another ticket in the backlog, it does really start to weigh down on you. It just seems like here's just another thing I have to do. But you're right. Like there are opportunities. I can think of one example off the top of my head where we were submitting frequently to the App Store because our release cycle is so frequent, specifically the Apple's App Store. And it was right around the time that they started cracking down on what the changelog is, not the changelog, the description is. And you know how every app in the App Store says
bug fixes and improvements.
Yeah, bug fixes and improvements. And one day they decided, hey, you can't do that anymore. You have to have a more specific description, and it can't just be a copied and pasted.
Yeah.
And it was this at the time when we got rejected because of that, it was like, well, crap, what are we supposed to do now? Like, this presents a huge problem.
The person submitting may not even know like what that recent batch of changes is. Yeah, totally makes sense.
And so what that sparked was this like process improvement, where now we have like a paper doc of what we're supposed to put in there. And now I feel like our process is even more cohesive because it gets more people involved. You know, the product manager has to know what's going out in this release. Everyone has to be communicating better. Everyone knows what's going into a release, which overall is like a huge improvement, because before it's just so easy to say bug fixes and improvements. And then when you go back to like, oh, hey, we noticed in our analytics that the app has been crashing for the last like 2 or 3 weeks. And then you go back and you're like, well, what happened in the last two, like what shipped? And then
at
it's
a high
like,
level. Yeah.
And then you're like, well, I don't know what shipped. We shipped bug fixes and improvements.
That's all we shipped was bug fixes and improvements.
Yeah. So overall, seeing this like blocker initially, like this initial problem of like, okay, crap, we just got rejected from the App Store. And then thinking like, okay, actually, what can we do to improve this process? Ultimately sparked really good change. And I think that framing your mindset of from the lens of like, how can we use this as an opportunity is really good.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next principle here is quality. And this one really stuck out at me. And I read it and reread it. And I was just like, shit, man, this really affects me. And I don't know what I think yet, or if I agree or disagree. I don't know if there's something to disagree with. I think it just might be truth. And I'm just like trying to absorb and accept that. Okay. So this is the quote from the book. It says, quote, "Sacrificing quality is not effective as a means of control. Quality should never be a control variable." So basically he's saying, these are the variables you should change. You should be able to change your time. I'm going to ship it in a week versus a month. You should be able to change your cost. I'm going to spend $2,000 versus $20,000. And you should be able to change your scope. You know, I want the app to do 3 things. I want the app to do 10 things. But his argument here is that you should never, ever compromise your quality. And I feel like this is a really extreme statement, and one that I really struggle with, because my types of clients that I work with are very cost sensitive. Like, they're early stage, scrappy startups. And to some degree, I sometimes feel like, well, it doesn't really matter if that piece of code is kind of shitty, because it's small stage, we'll fix it later, it's okay to have technical debt. But the author is making an argument that that should never be a control variable. Like, no matter what, everything that I ship should vary in cost, in our time, and in our scope. And really, the main control variable is scope, but never in the quality of what I'm building. So like, to kind of put it a different way, it's, you know, imagine you're building a car and you have a certain standard and a quality you build that car for. You can put a smaller engine in it. You can put less seats in the car. You can maybe sacrifice the radio or the air conditioning, but you're not going to sacrifice the quality of the actual engine and components and the quality of metal you put into that car. And so his argument here is that you never, ever want to skimp on quality, that if you do, it'll end up costing you more time and money. And I will say, by experience, when I have tried to cut cost on a project by doing the same number of features shittier, it ends up taking even more time to build less features with higher quality. And I feel like no matter what, it really goes back to this idea of like, complex things are complicated, and sometimes you just need code. Like, a complicated domain requires a complicated code base, and there's not much you can do about that. I think that's kind of the truth here. Like, we all want to get more features out the door for less money, but it's just not doable. Like, ultimately, less is less. There's no other way to shape that. But I don't know if there's an argument that you should never cut quality. I'm feeling like he's right, and I should just accept it, and I should start building with more quality and not try to sell work that has a longer feature list, but a shorter feature list that's more focused. Like, that would be even better from a business standpoint. So I don't know why my brain is wanting to argue with this idea. It sounds good to me, but I'm kind of struggling with accepting this idea that you should never skimp on quality. Do you have any thoughts, JP?
Yeah, but okay. Wow. Yeah, it is kind of extreme, but my question to you then would be, are we talking about quality of everything? Like, does that mean that I have to ship, I should always ship a product where the code quality is 100% there, and the user experience, more importantly, is also 100% there? Because I do feel like there has to be a compromise sometimes. I think first and foremost, you should never compromise on the quality of the user experience, because at the end of the day, that's sort of what we're building for, right? We're building products for people. But does that mean that the code should never suffer too. I don't know. I'm trying to rack my brain around it, because it just seems like an impossible thing where, you know, you can cut time, cost, money, scope, but you can never cut quality. I guess that is true though, because you never want like shitty code quality, like, because it's like a broken window, right? Back from Pragmatic Programmer. As soon as you have one broken window, as soon as you're like, I'm just going to throw all these components into one file, I'm going to throw all of these methods into one huge class, then it's like a broken window, and then all of a sudden your code quality is shitty, but like maybe the user experience is great, and then all of a sudden you have like a pile of tech debt.
Yeah.
So I can now talking out loud, I can see why this is a thing. It just like hurts me to the core, because maybe in my life I'm sacrificing on quality, and it just hurts to hear that.
I'm definitely sacrificing on quality, and like I knowingly ship code that I'm not 100% happy with. I feel like many times I get it to that 70-80% point and push it out the door, and if I had one less feature in that batch, I could probably get it to that 95 where I'm like proud of the work versus like happy with it and checking the box and getting the feature out the door. And it totally works and it is sustainable. But I think where the author is coming in, he's saying, if you do compromise quality to adjust for time and cost, you're going to end up spending more money and time anyway. If you use quality as a control variable, it will bite you in the ass later. It might not be this first round on the project, but when you go to try to do an update to that project, like, oh my God, like you're going to have so much more work doing that. And I think that that's the idea that I really like behind extreme programming, is it's being a little bit dogmatic and very honest with yourself about the reality of the situation. And the reality of the situation is I should probably work with that client to be like, client, if $10,000 is your budget, we can do these 4 features. We can't do the 20 features. That's what we can do in the quality that we ship as an agency. Like that's what I can do in the quality that I write in the code that I write. And looking back, I do have a tinge of regret, and I wish I had the honesty with myself and with my clients and self-awareness to ship with that type of quality from day one. And there is a piece of me that feels like I compromised not only my work as a developer, but as an agency. And I compromised what that client could have executed on being more focused. I feel like we could have gotten a better product because less is more in so many ways when you're an early stage startup. Now that said, I don't think that I've done anything wrong. I don't think I've done anything morally wrong. I think that someone came to me and said, I want to build these 20 features as cheap as possible and have it work. Well, it's still running. It's in the world and we've got those 20 features still running. But also in hindsight, I feel like if we would have focused more and had more quality, we not only would have shipped faster and better, we would have a better base now moving into the future. And I think their product might have been more successful because it would have been more focused from day one. So I think this is one that I really am figuring out what this means day to day and how I can even go in the middle of a project and start building this way. I wonder if there's something that I can do to kind of mid-project readjust our scope for cutting scope versus cutting quality. But this one really hit me, and I think it's a really good approach to things. Never cut quality. Cut your increase your cost, cut your time, reduce your scope, but never quality. And that's very much Basecamp's thing too. And if I respect them, like they're doing some amazing shit.
Yeah, it sounds to me like if you were to start implementing a practice today based on this principle, it would be to focus on the things that matter.
Yeah, for sure. Focus on the core.
Yep. Cool. Okay. So the last principle that we're going to talk about today is failure, which sounds like, what? We've been talking about all this positive stuff. Why are we talking about failure? But this is the quote. The quote's, if you're having trouble succeeding, fail. Don't know which of the 3 ways to implement a story? Try all 3 ways. When you don't know what to do, risking failure can be the shortest, surest road to success, which I thought was really interesting because Kent Beck included this story about, I don't know if it was like a hypothetical or if it was an actual story, but it was basically, it was, I think, like 3 designers arguing over how they should implement something. And dude, I have definitely been in meetings with engineers and product managers and designers and people in the room. Even at WizTutor, we did this all the time, where we would talk about a feature and we would argue back and forth because we had to give our 2 cents and we had to say our piece. And all it did was it ended up having 3-hour meetings where we would just talk about a feature and how we wanted to specifically implement it in our own specific way. So in the context of WizTutor, we might have a user story that's, as a user, I want to be able to book recurring sessions. And, you know, obviously you have a diverse group of people in there. You have a designer in there, me at the time. You have engineers, you have, you know, you have like your marketing people, and they all want to approach solving this user pain point a certain way. Basically, what Kent Beck advocates for is just fail. Try every way, be agile, iterate quickly, and, you know, try every approach. Like the time you spent arguing over like who is right and whose approach you should take, you could have probably done all three or four of them. And I thought that was a super, super interesting approach. I'm very curious to read the practices around failure, because, you know, in my head, the way that you should go about failing is to iterate quickly, but it kind of goes against this idea of never cutting quality, because I feel like there just has to be some compromise in quality when you're shipping quickly, but maybe there isn't. I know that Facebook used to have this like really famous mantra of ship fast and break things, which I think ended up becoming like too toxic or something like that. And so now they have, I think now their new mantra is like ship fast and
with stable infrastructure.
Yeah, with stable infrastructure. Which maybe is because now they're more extreme in their quality, and quality is never a control variable. So yeah, do you have any thoughts on failure?
Yeah, for sure. I think it goes back to that old Thomas Edison quote where he was like 5 years into trying to make a new light bulb. And they're like, you've spent 5 years on this. You've tried 10,000 materials and types of light bulbs. Like, are you going to give up? And he's like, I haven't failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work. And like, that's very much how Edison saw it. And finally, it was like the 10,012th time. It was like just after that he actually found the light bulb material, which is tungsten, by the way, that does work to make a light bulb. And I think there's a lot of value in trying things that don't work and being persistent and iteration. That's the name of the show. And like iterating on that until you find that. I also think specifically in the context of design, I had a new user experience designer start with the agency recently. And one of her first big projects she brought to me, we did a video call on it, screen share on it. We're talking through this design. And we both realized in the call that it was the wrong direction, that this is not the way to execute it. But by the end of a call, we both were in 100% agreement that we knew the right direction and we found it through that wrong direction. And I think it's really important when you're looking at a really big problem to just start in any direction you can, start and fail. But I think it's really important to fail as cheaply and as early as you can. And I think that good ideas come from 50 bad ideas. That's the only way you get good ideas. So I think this concept of failure and being okay with failure at a small scale, like small bets, makes a lot of sense. I don't lean all the way into this that's like, oh, I've started 5 companies, they've all failed, so I'm a huge success. Like, okay, calm down. That's not what I mean by failure is a good thing. And I think that there needs to be a time box and a constraint on failure. So I think specifically in the example of like WizTutor in design, I think it's really important to keep that in like the wireframing or whiteboarding or user testing front end type of thing and not in deployed code. There is times to just try something in production, but I don't think necessarily you have to skimp on the quality to do that. Especially if you're doing the pre-work ahead of time, which is the wireframing, the customer interviews, the proving out those hypotheses ahead of time. But I think when we're talking about this concept of failing, it's when you're looking at a problem so insurmountable, you don't know where to start. Start something. Even it may not be the right thing. You might have to find 8 or 9 ways or 12 ways or 100 ways to do it wrong. You're still smarter than Thomas Edison. He took 10,000 to find the light bulb, right?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think as humans, we want to get things right the first time, right? So it's like, hey, if I'm going to start working on this project, or if I'm going to start working on this feature, it's got to be right the first time. And I think a lot of this has to do with we don't want to fail and we don't want to waste time. There's things like the sunk cost fallacy. It's like, oh, I already spent so much time on this. Like we have to use this thing.
Yeah.
And I think the more you think about things as like disposable and, you know, hey, it didn't work, so let's do the thing that does work. I think that ends up building a better product. And I think you're right. Like just because we're talking about like failing doesn't mean that we mean fail and prod 10,000 times. It's more like, hey, there's tools like usertesting.com. You have people in your office. You have people that you can talk to and test things out. It's interesting
our risk in failure.
Exactly. I was listening to one of our old episodes. I forget which book, but we were talking about how you can prototype things using like Keynote. You could use like paper and pen
Totally.
And things like that. So you can try a bunch of things first. fail a bunch and then come to a really nice solution.
Absolutely. So the main topics we covered here, just to kind of blow through them, is humanity, self-similarity, diversity, opportunity, quality, and failure. So those are the ones we pulled out from these principles of extreme programming. So in kind of wrapping this up, principles are the thing that gives you an idea of what the practice should be within that principle. And behind principles are these values that kind of guide that overall thing. So understanding these principles gives you the opportunity to create practices that work in harmony with your existing practices and your overall goals. So I think it's important to kind of have in mind, what are your principles? And if you had any kind of homework while you're listening to this, is try to think through, what are the values that guide your work? And what are the principles that guide your work? And maybe some of these are ones that you want to pick up on. So I think that wraps it up. Do you have any closing thoughts, JP?
I think that's a good thought exercise too, is, you know, if you're very deliberate about something, like let's say me as a person, like I always want to start stand up at 10:15. Like I have to. Maybe it's a good idea for me as an exercise to think like, well, why do I want to start at 10:15? Mm-hmm. Is it because I need time in the morning, or like what is the value that guides me? Maybe it's that, you know, 10:15 just happens to be the time that all of my other teammates coming from, you know, the West Side are able to make it. So 10:15 is a good medium where we can all be in sync. So maybe the value there is that like having your team in sync is like what is most important to me. Yeah. Right. So maybe as a thought exercise, just think about like, hey, I really like doing these things, or I really stick by these things. What is the motivation behind that? And and then out of that, you can figure out what your values and principles are.
Absolutely. Cool. Do you have any picks for us this week, JP?
Yeah. So my pick this week, I feel like I'm doing a lot of self-care picks. So my pick this week is recently I went to Burke Williams, which is kind of an expensive like spa place. And I got a deep tissue massage while I was on my vacation.
Damn.
My staycation. And it was just like so relaxing. I told them, it's like, yeah, I sit in front of a computer 10 hours of the day. And I think that was like enough for them to know that I hold a lot of tension in my shoulders and like my upper back. And just having like someone grind their elbow into your back was the best thing I've done for myself in a while. It was great. I don't know.
I've never gotten a massage in my life. That I think I need to, just because like there's a weird mental hurdle that I should just get over with just like being comfortable with the idea. For some reason, it sounds like my absolute hell. Like having someone like touching my back and like feeling like I have to make small talk, and like I don't even know where to start on that. But I'm really glad you enjoyed it. And I just want to point out that the Burke Williams homepage says very big at the top, soothe and smooth for summer. So JP has been officially soothed and smoothed for summer, I think.
Yeah, I love that alliteration. What's your pick?
That's awesome. I honestly should do a massage. I bet it would be really good for me to get into that. So my pick for the week is actually a weird app. And at first I was like, this is so strange. So I'll give a little bit of context around my pick and then I'll get into it and we can wrap up. So I am somebody who likes to track things. I really track my runs and my cycling. I track my hours that I work. I try to track a lot of things in my life, including my sleep. And I don't know what really sparked, but I had this epiphany that I don't track my happiness. And if there's one metric I actually care about in my life, it's not like my body fat percentage, and it's not whether or not I slept. It's whether or not I'm happy. And I thought about this for a second. I was like, if there was one metric that I really cared about, it would be my happiness, which is like very odd. And it's not that I was feeling overly depressed. It was just more of this idea of like the quantified self and how I really have found a lot of value in tracking some of these things. And I was like, I wonder what insights there could be if I did. So I found this app called Mood, M-O-O-D, on the App Store. And basically, it's this app that you can set it up to remind you a couple times a day. And it just has a grid of emojis. And you just tap the emojis and you can add a note if you want. But I've been doing this for about 3 weeks. And it's crazy how much more mindful it's made me of my emotions throughout the day and how I'm feeling. It's made me stop work early. It's made me drink less coffee, watch less TV. Like, it's crazy about how just being more mindful of my emotions has done so much. And to understand the types of things that lead to negative emotions, like I realized if I have more than 4 meetings in a day, I have very negative emotions associated with that day. And it's just too much. Like, I don't get anything else done and I don't enjoy the day. And so in only the last 2.5, 3 weeks, I think it's about 3 weeks, I've moved from 44% negative emotions to 55% positive emotions. So like it kind of tells you overall whether you're negative or positive. And so like I was 66% negative, and now I'm how do I say this? 55% negative. I don't know how to say that. But anyway, also says there's like a good margin of change in my overall emotions and awareness. And like, there's some of this that's like bias of myself, because like I'm entering those things, but it's, you know, in theory, it's similar times of the day and I am filling it out the same way. So I even think just the idea of just being more mindful of how I'm feeling is helping me find more joy in things, which has been really great. And I've gotten a lot out of it. I think I'm going to keep it up another 2 weeks. And I think it's one of those things where like counting calories, you don't have to do it forever, but doing it for a month or two, like gives you a good base of data to work from and being more mindful about your food. So I've really gotten into it. It's called Mood.
Cool. Yeah. I checked it out in the App Store too. And I just loved how simple of a concept it was. You just tap the emoji. Like you don't, it's like so non-committal. You don't even have to sign up at first. Yeah. Only if you want to save your data. And it, I tested it out last night because I was like, ooh, what's this? But I think that's a very cool pick. I think I'm going to try it out for like a couple weeks and see just seeing something in front of you and being cognizant of like your emotions is probably a good way to just like understand them more and probably improve your overall outlook and mood in general.
Absolutely. Well, I've got a client call, so I've got to wrap up the recording. Cool. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening, and we will see you next episode.
Later.